the movement to end prohibition started out as part of a broad-based social justice movement in the 1960s. It was not a single issue, and we shouldn't see it as a single issue now.
Martin Lee, we want to thank you for being with us. Longtime investigative reporter, author of several books, including Smoke Signals, The Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. And that does it for our show. Our Labor Day special will bring you Questlove, Amir Thompson of The Roots. Tune in to that hour special. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feld, Sarah Mata, Yermin Shake, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
WHFR, Dearborn.
And now it's time for a public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. We are here for you each week from Henry Ford Community College on the all-volunteer, student-staffed, and alumni-staffed radio station. That's right. You could be listening online, so we're an internet streaming service, too, if you'd rather hear it that way. My name is Jay Koronick, and Dennis Reimars, our WHFR news director, is in the studio, too. Hi, Dennis. Welcome.
Hello. I think we have our... Hello?
Yes.
Perfect.
I hear you.
All right.
No one else can, but no, just joking. We have a lot of stories, local news and views, and boy, there's a lot of great views, that is, opinions, that are both in the local papers and some of the internet services for the local area. So let's get started right away, because it's not called the new WHFR Journal for nothing. And just remember, all opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of anyone else here at Henry Ford Community College. Already, from the Press and Guide last Sunday, that's August the 25th, today is, I didn't mention, August the 30th, in case you're listening on to the podcast sometime after broadcast, it is August 30th, 2013, so if there's something that twists or turns after that, don't blame me, because it's up to date as far as we know it right now. And by the way, if we don't get it right, yes, we do have an email address, whfr@hfcc.edu. Just send your comments or questions there, and it'll be forwarded to yours truly, and we can straighten things out if we get it wrong. One of the stories last Sunday, Dennis, mentioned Dearborn Heights City Council, which I know you're covering now, as since you're in their cable television video department over
there.
That's right. Oh, boy, very exciting. Do you have any comments, or you hear anything about their home rehab program that they're considering?
Boy, I don't think I'm on at all here. I'm not. Well, how are we doing down there?
Yeah. Try this. Can you hear yourself now?
Nope. Oh, there I am. Okay, you can hear me fine. Thank you.
Yeah, you were coming through. Just a headphone issue, folks. One of those behind-the-scenes issues.
No, well, I don't know much about it, okay, because this was not brought up at all.
Well, very good.
I've got the story here.
All right.
I just thought it was interesting because it involves one of the candidates for city council in Dearborn. Okay, City Council of Dearborn Heights, a week ago Tuesday, listened to a presentation from Tarek Beydoun. Mm-hmm. He is the person who was scheduled to be here for an interview and then didn't show up and didn't follow up and didn't call, didn't write.
We're still after him.
Yeah, we're still open, Tarek. No disrespect. Things happen, but normally professionals that, and you are one because you have this company called Salem One, and anyway, professionals normally would follow up. He made a presentation about a housing redevelopment project, and that's what his company is all about, redevelopment company, Salem One, proposing to renovate between 15 and 80 houses in Dearborn Heights over the next year. Under the proposed pilot program, Beydoun said the city wouldn't buy, renovate, or have titles for any of the homes, nor would it have any liability for them. Salem One would. Beydoun, a Dearborn City Council candidate, proposed creating a strategic development partner program with the city under the National Community Stabilization Trust. And what is that, you ask? The NCST, according to the story here, is a nonprofit organization sponsored by six leading national organizations in the housing and community development field, such as U.S. Housing and Urban Development, Habitat for Humanity, who has helped build or rebuild a few houses here in Dearborn already. Rebuilding Together is another group and other groups, and was created expressly for the purpose of assisting local communities to weather the foreclosure crisis, or the foreclosure storm. Let's follow the metaphor there, weather the storm. The program has been compared to the neighborhood stabilization program administered by HUD, Housing and Urban Development Department, which is a federal program that provides communities with resources to stabilize neighborhoods in distress as a result of high rates of foreclosure and vacancy, but without the red tape. Okay, so they don't have any red tape. Under NCST, private for-profit companies are also rehabilitating houses, and that's an example of Salem One that Mr. Beydoun is the head of, I guess. They have 12 years of experience, and they've worked with Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. We know how great they are, right?
Sarcasm.
Yeah, sarcasm. And nonprofit organizations such as Mana Development Group and National Faith Homebuyers. Councilwoman Pro Tem Janet Badalow said it seems like it could be a fruitful partnership. Bears fruit, and she favors the houses being sold to home buyers versus sold as rentals. She says, we have a vested interest in actually having the homes being rehabbed properly and being sold at a fair market value. I don't want rentals. We have enough rentals in the city. Other council members said that they will send the information to City Attorney Gary Miatke for review and consideration. Is he the only city attorney over there?
He's corporate counsel, yes.
He doesn't have any underlings?
No.
Okay. In Dearborn, I think, what's her name?
Wally.
Yeah, I think she's got a few in her office that help. Anyway.
Is that her full-time gig, though, the city attorney?
Yeah.
Gary is a practice, I believe, in Allen Park.
Oh, so it's a part-time thing for what? Yeah. Maybe he's on retainer, so to speak.
Probably.
Whenever somebody sues, he jumps into action.
No, he's at the meetings, and I see his money coming out and being paid.
Well, I know, because like Deborah Walling in Dearborn, she needs to be at the council meetings, because when a legal issue comes up, the council people need to have sort of an opinion, not an official ruling, but they need an opinion right then. So it's appropriate that Mr. Miatke is there. So they're going to look into it. Beydoun also has ties to another rehab company, Metro Property Group, from which he stepped down as its attorney in October 2012. Because they were dealing with foreclosed homes in Detroit. And that company is being sued in federal court over allegations of fraud and racketeering.
Oh, boy.
So no wonder he wanted to get out of there. But he was their attorney during that period. So I wonder, Debbie Schlussel. A conservative attorney and commentator.
She's a national figure.
A commentator.
She is. She goes after, in Dearborn specifically, some of the, I don't know what you want to call them, groups that are, I hate to use the word terrorist, but I know she writes frequently, or she used to write frequently about that.
Well, she's the one that began the suit against Metro Property that Beydoun formerly was the attorney of, back up until 2012. It's interesting. So, and here we have a radio or TV commentator, because I'm not familiar with what her medium is.
I've only read her, but
maybe
I think she's
every
on
medium.
Radio.
Okay. Yeah. Well, these days you have to be on multiple mediums if you really want to.
But she's very critical of like how attorneys prosecute or don't prosecute.
Yeah, because that company which she's suing, she's accused them of marketing houses in Detroit to investors all over the world as money-making investments. And they allegedly presented fake documents, including leases with forged signatures. Beydoun told the Press and Guide in May that he firmly denied any wrongdoing, and that Schlussel's allegations are, quote, scandalous and fraudulent, his words. He also said that he didn't expect to be a party in the litigation. So
even though he stepped down, he is part of the suit?
No, he doesn't expect to be a party in the litigation at this point. Metro Property Group filed a counterclaim So they sued back, or made counter charges or whatever, while probably they shouldn't have been charged in the first place.
Right.
That's what I think a counterclaim is, July 30th. Where's Morris Goodman when we need him?
I know.
He needs to be our lawyer sitting here every day, every time we broadcast, so we don't get in trouble ourselves, I guess. But anyway, so that's interesting, I think. And my question is, I guess it's good. Why doesn't Mr. Badoon, if he's running for city council in Dearborn, why doesn't he direct his Salem One company to help Dearborn out? I guess we don't have a high enough rate of foreclosures here? Or vacancies? Maybe. I thought we had a pretty interesting rate. I'm not sure it was high, but, I mean, we do have foreclosures and vacancies, I know.
I would think so at the same time. I mean, to do this kind of rehab, you have to get them really, really dirt cheap. And I don't think Dearborn maybe has that. Obviously, in Detroit, he found that situation, was appealing there.
So you think Dearborn Heights is dirt cheap?
I think compared to Dearborn, it's much cheaper, yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, property values in general, maybe.
That's what I mean.
A little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. Depends on location.
It does.
Location
everything
is everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Also, he would have a conflict of interest trying to pitch this right now while he runs for Dearborn City Council, which he might have been aware of. I mean, Dearborn City Council wouldn't approve it right now because it might make him look good, and then one of them wouldn't be back in the fall if he can showboat a little bit. I mean, showcase his talents, let's say,
his timing
in front of the council. So he... It just wouldn't be right for him to go, even if Dearborn could use the service of Salem One. And as he said, it's a pilot program. If Dearborn Heights goes for it and it's successful, maybe he would expand and help Dearborn if that company has truly proven itself, of course.
And that makes him look good. The timing on this is pretty good for him if it works.
Yeah. So that's the full story. I just thought it was kind of interesting just because he was a council candidate here and gives you a little more background on him since he wouldn't come on the air with us. And
well, yet.
Give that yet. Yes.
You know,
there's still time.
He did.
Derek,
we did
we'd love to talk to
sure.
you. Yeah. And as I said, things happen. Sometimes I forget totally where I am. So
it's so much fun when you do that.
Yeah. Right. But then I look down at the required faculty ID card that we're now expected to wear around our necks. Next thing, they want to put a chip in my neck.
Don't wait till you're asleep. It's probably already
on there. Campus, faculty have to wear this lanyard and this picture ID showing who we are. Of course, mine doesn't look like me anymore at all. They need to take my picture again someday. But and it says I'm in the Fine Arts Division, which doesn't exist anymore. So anyway, but yeah, so I know who I am. I just look down at my lanyard here.
Or you can ask me. I'll let you know.
Thanks. Appreciate
I'll
that.
I'll be honest, most of the
okay.
time.
Back to school is near, but those of you who have children will know that it starts after Labor Day, whatever the appropriate time and start time is. And remember that Edsel Ford parents, as we mentioned last week, because Edsel Ford High School now is in the red zone. That's the color that the state of Michigan has given to them as the lowest achiever, according to several different criteria. It's the lowest group in Michigan, and it's definitely needs to be under supervision by the state, not emergency manager, but under supervision, and because it's in this...
It's called the priority now.
Yeah, it's called priority, but it's the lowest category. It's not a... Yeah, it's high priority to help them because
right.
they're in the lowest. And there's a lot of questions that have been raised about, even by the Board of Trustees this week, apparently,
right.
the Board of Education. We thought they had a good reputation, they said. How come Edsel Ford is in the bottom? How come they're in the red? I mean, other schools in Dearborn and nearby are not in the red. And we have an editorial comment from the Press and Guide, which you'll see in this coming Sunday's edition, but it's on their website, pressandguide.com, right now, just this morning, and I want to share that with you. But my point here about school starting is that Edsel Ford, for almost all students, interestingly, not for all of them, but for most of the students that go to Edsel Ford, they're going to have to be there an extra hour because they need an extra hour of education or something. It's one of the plans that are in place now, so they're going to stay there till 3:15 instead of 2:15, but they're the way it was phrased in the last story I read, that's not all students, so there's some exceptions to that. I'm not sure what it is, so if you're a parent, and by all means check with the school administration or the Dearborn School's website. Something else I was thinking about there, Dennis, you had a comment?
Well, my comment is that in that same article you're talking, or it might be in the editorial, you know, you're going to read it, but they had four choices, and this going to school later in the day was, that was one of the choices. It was part of a bunch of different things they could do. You know, one of the choices was closing the school. I mean, that was very real possibility. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's just way too many students. I think the other schools are already overcrowded. And then one of the other choices was turning over half the staff. So I think that whatever they did in fact opt for made the most sense. What are you looking for?
The editorial.
Oh. Hmm.
It was right here somewhere.
Isn't it right there? In the paper? Did you have
no, it? It's not. It's going to be next Sunday. So.
Oh, I see.
What did I do with it? Well, Dennis is going to search for the editorial. I can summarize it, sure. But not as well as if I can read it out loud. I just had it in front of me here.
Is this live radio? Oh, yeah. You can believe it.
So Dennis is going through everything. We'll find it.
Here it is.
Somehow. Thank you.
But the other point about Edsel Ford, other than this opinion that's coming up, and the later start date, but it's not for all of them. Well, okay, let's do the editorial. Maybe that other point will come up here. It's a pretty strongly stated editorial. Whoever is responsible for writing that now at the Dearborn Press and Guide, maybe someone from the area, the region. It is typical with most newspapers that the paper editorial comment is not signed. Although if you look at the credits, like who's the publisher, who's the regional editor, and so on, it's probably one of them. But I want to give a lot of credit to them for having such very well-written and were very well-expressed points of view on matters of concern to Dearborn over the last couple of months. And I think that's what a newspaper should do, a local paper. It's just another point of view, folks. You don't have to believe it, but it's another point of view. And they always feature, of course, a number of very good writers like Morris Goodman, Craig Foran, and others to put their essays in there, not just little letters or a paragraph or something, or commentaries. Gee, you can do that online. You know, you can do a soundbite or tweet or whatever. So, but what a paper should really be good for, I think, is a somewhat longer and more in-depth comments. I like this editorial. So, first of all, just to summarize the first part, they do criticize the state of Michigan for the way they have this organized and how it couldn't be announced until August 20th. Remember last week, Dennis, we said, I wonder if, well, now that it's true, I wonder if some students can switch and go to another school.
Yeah, school of choice.
Since they found it. No, it's too late.
Too late.
That the state wouldn't allow that. And also,
probably had to be done last spring.
A lot of the preparation for the school year, you know, they actually make plans. Teachers and administrators make plans for what we're going to do. It's all out the window.
All of it.
Per the state's orders. And he and whoever is writing, he or she, the editorial here, says it's unfair to expect so much to change in such a short period, like 2 weeks.
Right.
And get this. This is the worst part. It's going to cost the district a lot of money that they don't really have because of this. The district now, the Dearborn School District, must invest $2 million of its at-risk money into the school. And about $500,000 additional, so $2.5 million they're out because of this redlining or red color bottom of the list category that Edsel Ford is in, to rent extra buses and drivers to take home some students because of the later dismissal time. So I guess if they would have stayed at 2:15, they could just sort of shared the buses that are already out there. They're mm-hmm. already sort of, pardon the expression, staggered.
Right.
Not the drivers, but the bus schedules. And so I go so far for a cheap pun. But the $500,000 to rent extra buses and drivers because the extra hour is now mandated. Wasn't part of the original plans, but it's now mandated. And $2 million more dollars of whatever is called their at-risk money. So maybe they already had a fund for at-risk things. But anyway, it has to be dedicated now just to Edsel Ford. And I would say it's $2.5 million a school district could probably make really good use of some other place, or would rather, especially if you're a taxpayer in Dearborn, rather not have to
right.
pay out in the first place.
Fix a nice roof with that.
Yeah. So there's that about the buses. Maybe that was the follow-up to the later start time that I wanted to mention from this article. What I really wanted to mention is also in the editorial. We mentioned it last Friday. If you're a concerned parent in the community, Edsel Ford or not, but especially for Edsel Ford parents, this Monday at 7 p.m., okay?
Monday or Tuesday? Monday's Labor Day.
You know, This came out this Friday.
Yeah, today.
How could they have a 7 p.m. Liberty? Oh, it's because school starts the next day.
Does it Tuesday? Or I thought it started Wednesday, but okay.
Well, something starts Tuesday. I mean,
the teachers do.
Maybe teachers. Right. A half day for kids. I don't know, but I'm just saying. No, I was just, yeah, isn't that terrible? That's probably, if people are going up north, they're just barely getting back.
Mm-hmm. Up north or further.
Yeah. Well, they were also surprised that no parents addressed the school board this week when given the opportunity at the start of this last Monday's meeting. That's the first meeting they've had as a Board of Ed since the announcement. You would think some parents had heard, ooh, Edsel Ford, it's at the bottom. Why the heck is that?
Right.
That they would go and complain and ask questions. But I think they don't read the papers that much. I'm sorry, you know. But if you're listening to this show, maybe we're, because you got the word, we got the word out here last Friday about that meeting, about the meeting coming up for the parents. Maybe you're waiting for Labor Day evening. It says 7 p.m. Monday, Dennis.
No kidding.
Yeah, so check with the school. But Edsel Ford High School will have a meeting for parents at 7 p.m. Monday.
It's at the school?
At the school, at Edsel Ford High School. And they it says you certainly should ask questions, this is the editorial speaking here, of the administration school board at that time.
Wow.
And by the way, this oversight by the state, and they say Edsel Ford High School is now stuck in state oversight purgatory, which is, I understand, not fun, from what I'm told from other people who've been there, like Dante.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Dante's inferno.
He talked about purgatory, too.
Sure.
His story is actually a trilogy.
Right.
And so, you know, you go through hell, but then there's purgatory, and then there's heaven at the end, and nobody ever reads the last one because it's no fun.
Right.
Marshmallows and white togas, and there's no sex, you know, so it's not a lot of fun up there. And so anyway, it's just interesting. The only hell, let's read about hell, you know. That's why the Inferno was so popular since, what was it, 14th century Italy? Yeah, it was a lit major, folks. I'm sorry. But
Don't get started on Machiavelli.
Purgatory existed, at least in the dogma. Woof, woof. Way before that. So, anyway, 4 years, though, of the state oversight now just because it accidentally got in there. So even if it does really well next year, the state still sort of guides and suggests and dictates what can happen at Edsel Ford. Did you know that was the case? We heard about the emergency managers for whole school districts and, of course, for cities. But did you know they can do it now for individual schools that can take over within a district? Now, not really complete takeover. They don't appoint someone, but they monitor all the plans.
Well, if one of your options is overhauling half of your staff, then I'm sure they have some say in that. They're,
well,
you know what I mean? There'll be
yeah,
people
I mean,
involved.
They at the start, they said there's four options. Close the school.
Well, can't do it.
No. Restart the school, whatever that means.
Yeah.
You know, maybe new administrators, just clear the decks.
Right.
Replace half the staff. Is that a realistic thing to do?
No,
this is the state of Michigan.
But I think that they made these unrealistic so people would pick for it.
The last one is the transformational approach where you could, and that's what Dearborn chose, of course, to gradually make changes in a number of ways and get better. And, of course, I mean, where did those other three ideas come from? Who wrote those out anyway?
Close your school.
Well, in some areas, maybe you got too many schools, like declining populations in, like, Detroit.
Right.
Don't need as many schools, although then you have long bus rides and you got to get more buses out there. So
that editorial, does it not say, a little earlier, puts this in context, because it says, yes, they're doing poorly, but they're not by any means the worst of the schools out there.
Right. But that aside, and of course, the Board of Ed, a couple people on the board, of course, said, they can't understand what these criteria are about. And Craig Foran makes a comment on that I think I can share with you, too, today from his editorial opinion. But what I was surprised is the editorial goes on to say that there is a second major problem that's external. It's really a community problem that has affected Edsel Ford High School. And here we go. The Dearborn Press and Guide editorial, which you'll see in the paper Sunday and on their website now, says the Edsel Ford community and the community in general should use this opportunity to address a culture of disharmony among students, namely white, black, and Arab. There is a tension among the groups born not just of teenage testosterone run amok, but of inexcusable intolerance. Now, I think I even mentioned last Friday that when my daughter was there and graduated in the 90s from Edsel Ford High School, there were fights in the hallways between primarily whites and Arabic populations Arab Americans. And I thought I heard that that had much diminished, that we're past that, because we don't have that much new immigration in Dearborn like we did in the 70s and 80s and 90s even. And people have accustomed themselves to Dearborn and the culture here. And the people who are already here learn more and more about the Muslim religion. And
my son graduated from Not So Forward in 2000.
The culture from the Middle East?
2008, and he said that everybody got along like one big happy family, and he wasn't being sarcastic.
Well, that's what I'm just wondering, what sources did the editor of the Press and Guide use for making these comments? Because it sounds like there's fighting all the time. It says, for far too long, there have been tensions, some of which have led to fistfights among the groups. So what I've heard indirectly in Dennis from 2008 from his son, that's not really too much the case anymore.
Now, when the economy went bad, it became more affordable to live in certain areas that wasn't before, and maybe that brought in an element, and maybe that's the root of the problem. I don't know. I know that there's a lot more garbage around where we used to live, a lot more litter.
You suggested that maybe there's a change in the socioeconomic situation in the Edsel Ford High School area.
In that area over there behind Oakwood Hospital. Yeah. Changed a lot.
It's interesting to me, because I had heard it before, that now there's, he seems to indicate that there's black groups or cliques that are also not in harmony with the whites and the Arab populations. So that's quite a, and I put an exclamation mark on the piece of paper here, that's quite a strong statement to make. I'd like to see the proof or the evidence from the teachers at Edsel Ford High School and the principals there about what are the incidents and what are those tensions like, even high school students there. What is this accurate? I mean, it is the editor's opinion here from the Press and Guide, but that I don't think he'd go this far, or she, if they didn't have the evidence.
Now, remember, this is a... That was a first-year principal. This will be the principal's second year there. Mm-hmm. And I can't even imagine it. Like I said, I lived right in that area. My kids walked to school at Edsel.
Well, like a good essay should have and a critique of society, the editorial concludes with the statement that what the school district should do. It says it should address the issue at Edsel Ford, which has the biggest balance of diversity among the three schools. But it should also address it on the elementary and middle school level so students learn the value of diversity during their formative years before they even get to high school. The district should start programs that bring East and West Dearborn together. And, when I read that, I think, why doesn't the city do that, too? It's a city problem. Why doesn't the city think of some way to do this? But as he says, or she, especially on the elementary level, they should have these programs that bring East and West together, so to speak, where the children are most impressionable. They can make friends from the opposite side of the Southfield Freeway. Ooh, the opposite side of the Southfield Freeway. Okay. Don't go on the freeway, kids. It's too dangerous. Okay. But you can cross over on the appropriate sidewalks. Anyway, they say these friendships that they might get could last well beyond their elementary years, like maybe into high school. The programs could be anything from having children from two elementary sister schools, as they call it. There's like sister cities in the world. Is Dearborn have a sister? I can't remember.
They always
Toledo does. It's Toledo in Spain. Yeah.
Really?
Toledo, Ohio. They've got this relationship with the city of Toledo in Spain.
I thought Dearborn did, now that you bring that up.
Of course, the most famous Toledo in the world is Toledo in Spain.
Sure.
But, you don't have to have the same name, folks, to be a sister city.
No,
I don't know how that happens, but anyway. That was one suggestion. Also, and I wonder the age or the generation of the editorial writer here for the Press and Guide. He says the children, after they meet them on a field day, a fun field day, could then become pen pals. Does anybody use pens anymore? Maybe they could tweet back and forth. Or,
I think pen pals is still a generic term.
Is it?
For communicating.
I never use that because, boy, that's really old.
Didn't you when you were younger, though? You probably had your share of pen pals.
I didn't have any pals.
Well, in France, didn't you write to somebody?
My mother.
Well, that was when you were in France.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
Did you write to somebody in France from America?
No, no.
Well, we did that as part of my
French daughter
class.
Did, and my daughter was part of the French travelers or whatever they called them in the Dearborn Public Schools. They had a relationship every year. The fifth graders would go to France.
How cool!
And then we'd get theirs, and I had a French student from France that we helped acclimatize themselves for, what was it? It seemed like forever, but it was like 2 weeks or something like that here in Dearborn. So they attended school in Dearborn, and thank goodness I knew French.
Yeah.
And that was why I volunteered, too, because the girl was kind of precious, let's say. Didn't want to speak English at all, even though she probably knew English better than I did. But anyway, he suggested a couple of things, and that's good. A good editorial, if you got a criticism, at least give us an idea of what you're thinking of for a change. And those programs, East and West, the schools would be better for them, and so would the community, is the conclusion. And I think that's great. I'm going to go with a couple of commentaries now on the show and feature Craig Foran's comment, because Foran thinks the problem is really this Common Core requirement. Part of the Common Core program is taking over these poor schools or these badly performing schools individually, not the whole school district, but this like identification in colors. And then, so he's got really good thoughts because he felt, I got to think this through, and he does in his essay. So I'd like to feature that next. But here's a couple comments, and they're both based on Jim Hightower. He's from Austin, Texas. But the first thing he mentions, and it does relate to Dearborn, he talks about the death of green lawns. And, you know, my neighbor, all my neighbors, they cut their grass every week. They cut it very short. Oh, just like a golf course, yeah. But, you know, golf courses, they have to water a couple times a day, even when it's cool out, or the grass is going to burn out. And, of course, it's always a losing battle, at least with the neighbors on my street in East Dearborn, because they cut it so short, there's no, like, shade that it can give itself. And even though they have automatic sprinklers and are watering all the time, which is a waste of water, but I know they're paying the bill, it's still burning out. And I cut once every 2 weeks, or horrors, once every 3 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm ready for a ticket from the city of Dearborn to come by with their measuring stick. Ooh, it's 6 1/4 inches. You're going to get a ticket. But nobody's turned me in yet because in my front yard, I don't have any grass to speak of. A little bit, just on the edges. But I turned it into like a mini forest, you know, landscaping, as they call it legally in Dearborn. But nonetheless, in my backyard and that, I let it go long. I figured people can't see it as easily. And I water like once every 2 weeks. I mean, once every 2 weeks, but in Austin, Texas, and then in the Southwest, because of what? Global warming. The temperatures are going up so high that there just won't be green lawns there, or you get big tickets if you try it. And then sort of related to green lawns are gardens. Like you've heard about the Garden of Eden. Well, police are destroying
the gardens.
Your gardens.
Police?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, local police. And this is a spinoff on a commentary he had a couple weeks ago. But so listen up, folks. These things, they kind of talk about the Southwest of the U.S., but they both really relate back here to our city. Take a listen. Jim Hightower, populist commentator on WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
My father was an early member of a group now known disparagingly as Ultra Lawn People. High, as everyone called him, was dedicated body and soul to the Sisyphean task of trying to maintain a lawn full of lush St. Augustine grass in hot, dry Texas. He planted, watered, fertilized, watered, mowed, watered, fought bugs and brown patch, watered, replanted, watered, ad nauseum. Some years he won, in other years nature rolled him. High departed his lawn and this earth well before climate change turned Texas from merely hot and dry into scorched and parched. I know he would have denied it at first, but I think even he would have finally given in to today's new reality. In our drought-ravaged Southwest, the lush lawn is dead, literally and ethically. From Texas to Southern California, city after city is adapting to nature. They're policing neighborhoods to impose big fines on excessive lawn watering, paying homeowners and businesses to rip out grass and replace it with desertscapes, and even outlawing grass yards and new developments. And it's working. A pioneering 2003 turf removal rebate program in Las Vegas, for example, has now pulled 165 million feet of thirsty lawn grass out of the area, saved more than 9 billion gallons of water, and cut water use by a third, even as the population has mushroomed. This is Jim Hightower saying, such an effort would have been treated as heresy only a decade ago, but now it's simply considered the right thing to do. This is not merely an environmental adjustment, but a fundamental ethical shift, especially among younger people. The idea that green lawns are exercises in ecological narcissism has taken root in this arid and politically conservative region, demonstrating that conservatism really can be about conserving.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
The Bible tells us that the Garden of Eden was heaven on earth until Adam ate that apple. Then all hell broke loose. Recently, hell erupted in the garden again, this time in Arlington, Texas, on a small organic farm named Garden of Eden. At about 7:30 in the morning of August 2nd, a SWAT team of armed police agents, code enforcement officers, and narcotics detectives suddenly exploded all over Shelley Smith's little farm. They burst through the gate, handcuffed the terrified residents, and held them at gunpoint while the agents executed the raid's mission. Which was what exactly? A City of Arlington spokeswoman explained that the purpose was to improve the quality of life and to resolve life safety issues within neighborhoods. It seems there had been complaints about marijuana being grown and about the place being unkempt. So, what did the derring-do raiders achieve? They captured 17 blackberry bushes, 15 okra plants, 14 tomatilla plants, some native grasses, and all the sunflowers. Then, they whacked down Shelley's sweet potato patch with a weed eater and seized the farm's compost along with some wooden pallets, old tires, and furniture. Notice what they did not find? Marijuana plants, nor any other illegal products. In short, on the basis of rumor, autocratic police power was unleashed to improve the quality of life by destroying an organic farm. This is Jim Hightower saying, why would police resort to paramilitary force just to check out a few marijuana plants and some trash? Because right-wing officials and arms industry lobbyists have been pushing police departments all across America to switch from a peacekeeping approach to an aggressive, militarized SWAT mentality, with officers being armed, trained, and psyched to treat common citizens as enemies. To learn more, go to aclu.org/militarization.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
So that last story there is about where city police are being encouraged by federal government security teams, whether it's NSA or Homeland Security or whatever, to get very militant. Anybody suspicious, like growing marijuana, ooh, booga booga. They go in and they trash your place. I mean, I've heard stories about that from the IRA, and they totally have the power. Look out. They can go in, and if they think you owe even 5 cents, they can trash your house. They can kick you out of your house. They can take your car. That they don't even need legal action. You don't even have a chance to defend yourself until after the fact, after you're homeless on the street. They are the biggest Gestapo organization in the U.S., and most people, it doesn't happen that often in the U.S., and it's not publicized at all. It should be publicized more. Actually, there were several Law and Order episodes over the long run of that TV show on where the police were encountering times of IRS abuse of their powers. Okay, so if you're not a terrorist and you're not a tax evader, but you're growing marijuana, which is now legal in 16 states, not the federal level, but anyway, for various reasons and purposes in those states, of course, medical marijuana most commonly the reason, they can come in and trash your house. They don't have to apologize. They don't have to rebuild it. They don't have to, you know, give anything back or fix anything they broke. You really like that kind of abuse, you know? And then, of course, in the story that Jim Hightower pointed out, looking for marijuana plants, they didn't find any. There weren't any at all. But they ripped out very good bushes, like blackberry and all kinds. I guess they didn't know what a marijuana plant looked like. Yeah. So just take all of these anyway. I need a few blackberry bushes for my house at home, probably the police were saying or something. And they ripped up the garden, took everything away, and there wasn't a marijuana plant to be found anywhere. What did they think? It was growing under the blackberry bush? Give me a break here, you know. We need, as citizens, to stand up and resist in incursions into our privacy like that at all levels. Now, I know with quantum computing, look it up, folks, and the way technology is ever increasing and speeding up and so on, and especially the quantum aspect of computing, it's going to be hard not to surveil everybody all the time. I see just today it was on radio about Mayor Bloomberg was proclaiming in New York City that he now has a live video map that is actually showing by face recognition software from all their video monitors from the whole city where people are and what they're doing, and it's smart enough to see potential trouble.
Oh, geez.
And send the police there. So it's like it hasn't happened yet, but it could. It's like that sci-fi movie
yeah.
Minority Report that yeah. Tom Cruise was in, where he was part of a police force that the computer would say, these people might become criminals, or we think they definitely will be a criminal in 2 days. So you go out and you capture them. You know, no evidence, no proof, just the computer saying, we really think based on their behavior patterns, blah, 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 and the look on their faces, that they're going to do a bad thing. And, of course, there is that wonderful show on CBS, which will come back in the fall for the third season, which is called Person of Interest, in which supposedly a rogue computer programmer leaves the government computer system, but is still able to hack in, and that's a computer like what Bloomberg already has that looks constantly and facial recognition, scanning, trying to figure out who's at risk. But in this case, it's a do-gooder that this rogue programmer has hired sort of like a former secret agent to help these people. But he doesn't know how they're going to be in trouble, but they're going to be in trouble, so he is sent out 2 or 3 days in advance of when the problem results to try to be there to help them through whatever the heck is going to happen.
So they can they know the future.
The bad thing is the computer is already there in this sci-fi story at the federal level. Okay, but what it's doing with the info, it's not clear, but it's obviously a major privacy and security problem. And the fact, but he's trying to use the predictions of that computer for good. And it was fun. The last season, though, ended. He was actually, other people were trying to track down where was the computer service located? Where was this super, super, super smart computer that's pulling together all this info and making all these conclusions? And because the government wanted to know, because they didn't even know where it was. They just, you know, used their computer boards to connect with it, but they didn't actually know where it was, and he wanted to get there before they did to sort of protect it, if you will, or whatever. Well, it turns out they get to the warehouse, and there's just one guy sitting in the middle of the floor, and he said, oh, a bunch of trucks came yesterday, 8 trucks, and loaded up and left. It was all approved, and he showed all the computer was smart enough to know that they were out to get him, the computer, that they were coming for him.
Right.
Because he could surveil everybody.
He couldn't
intercept everything. No, but he makes the official forms and fills them in with legal signatures from the people that run the place, which is, if he falsifies that,
right,
to order the trucks and to pack him up and deliver him to another warehouse, and they don't know where he is now.
Oh, jeez.
But he's obviously gotten artificial intelligence, which is what quantum computing will definitely do, and he's going to protect himself, but he can see the government coming, you know, days in advance because of his powers. And now today, Bloomberg says he's got something sort of like that in New York City with all their surveillance cameras and facial recognition and probability.
Wow.
Formula. Is he going to have his police force go out and arrest people before they do anything?
Yeah. No, you can't. You can't arrest somebody before they commit a crime. You cannot.
Unless the president says they're terrorists.
Right. I've seen enough episodes of 24.
Yeah. I mean, no, that is legal. You don't need anything other than the person in charge to say they're a terrorist, we think they're a terrorist, or they're a terrorist suspect, they're gone, they're in prison forever, we're going to do all kinds of interrogation, and maybe you'll never see them again. And no right to trial or jury or due process, as it's called.
Or attorneys.
Right. So there are significant exceptions already, and quantum computing, artificial intelligence is going to be here. There's no doubt about it, but we need to make sure it's here in the right, appropriate way.
Real quick question. This is something that just crossed my mind. You were talking about TV shows. Do you remember we interviewed the gentleman who created the TV show after he had surgery, got a new heart? And then while he was in the hospital, he had a heart transplant. While he was in the hospital, he created this these series of novels that they used to watch the show.
Hmm.
It was on, like, Friday nights. It was a TV show. It was about somebody. Oh, gosh, and I can't remember what it was about. And I was wondering if it's still on the air, but I don't think so, because you're not showing any recognition at all.
No, I didn't catch that one, or if I did, it doesn't pop into my head.
We interviewed him on over the phone, and he had a heart transplant.
Oh, yes. It was a Thursday night. The Locator, and it was the same producer who did the Bones series.
That's right. Is Locator still on?
No, because the very strong African-American actor passed away suddenly.
Oh,
had a heart attack and died. He was only like 50-some.
No kidding.
Michael Duncan something or other. And he was in The Green Mile, and he was in many great
movies.
Oh,
love that guy, sure.
Yeah, and so I think it was up for renewal. They just finished their first season or second season, maybe, and then he died, and so I think that just sort of sealed the fate there. I don't think the ratings were high enough, unfortunately, and I never saw another book released by that author.
There's just three total, right?
Still looking, yeah, I guess.
Okay.
All right. You'd think there would have been a big splash if that other book. Remember, it was going to be some sort of expose on government security or something.
It was pretty deep.
I think the NSA grabbed him.
Yeah, Snowden. Security. Snowden tipped him off.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay, here, I'm looking for Craig Foran now. Here it is. He says, this is editorial opinion from last Wednesday, August 28th, Press and Guide. The headline is, "It finally dawned on me why some are opposed to Common Core standards." He says, "There's no question that what I'm about to write is going to anger some people." All right. All right. Let's get our blood flowing here. "Yet it's based on one of those eureka moments," he says, "a clarity of thought that was sitting right in front of me all along. Just a week ago, I wrote about the new color coding grading scale being assigned to public schools and charter schools, green, good, red, bad, and other colors in between. At the same time, I wrote about our state's refusal to fund the implementation of the Common Core standards for education. Sound familiar? No Child Left Behind under George Bush.
Yeah.
I thought a pretty good idea in general. And then Congress put no money for the funding needed to change the things in the schools throughout the country that they thought should be redirected. So it didn't happen, did it? No. It was a disaster. And there's still a lot of people left behind, or they were always behind. They're going to stay there, I guess. Okay, Craig goes on. He says, "At the same time, I wrote about our state's refusal to fund the implementation of the Common Core standards for education. I won't repeat my explanation of Common Core, but so far, 44 other states have embraced the new national standards, which do nothing more than establish what a child should be learning at each grade level. But state representative here in Michigan, Representative Tom McMillan, a Republican from Rochester Hills, talked his GOP brethren into stripping the funding from the new standards, something his own Republican governor is in favor of implementing." So Snyder was in favor of funding the money that would be needed for the new standards that are in place. "So instead of our schools being aligned with standards already agreed to, our teachers will be using the new standards, but testing to old standards. Can you see a looming disaster here?" he asks. "Yep, our schools could be in serious trouble. Red card. Because for the last 3 years, their teachers have been prepping for the Common Core standards. Remember what we said about Edsel Ford? They had all these plans in place. Gone. Okay? Standards that don't exist, thanks to McMillan and others, who said that he opposed the new standards because he felt they would infringe, quote, on local control, unquote. But then came news that pretty much made him out to be a teeny bit just disingenuous. And so Craig continues, it wasn't so much local control as it was local impact. You see, the new color coding scheme, which had been in the works for some time, is based on a points system. And according to a published report about recently released state data, most schools, quote, most schools, even many high-performing schools, may struggle to meet the state's eventual goal that 85% of students be proficient by the 2021 to 2022 school year. Was it 9 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I'm good at math.
You bet.
Uh-oh, says Craig Foran. Confused? You should be. This latest mess is the product of lawmakers, not educators, trying to design an education model. They're not very good at it. I guess they didn't have a very good education
No. In
the first place. And the job's already taken. And, of course, by whom are you following the law? The educators. Okay. Educators know how to design an educational system. Unfortunately, the legislature holds the purse string, so it can pretty much control the situation. As a result, we now have a color coding system based on a point system that's based on both instructional and non-instructional benchmarks. Of the 3,397 schools that got a color, only 96 got green. That's the top in Michigan. And according to the report, few of them were schools that consistently post top test scores, unquote. But it gets better, or worse. Nearly half of those 96 schools didn't get a green because of the state test scores. They got them simply because they tested more than 95% of their students and filed an annual report. Ooh, it's a little catch-22 thing. I mean, a little trap door.
Sure.
So maybe you got a lousy school, but you filed your annual report, and you had 95% of your students take the test, at least.
That's initiative.
Even though they might have all failed it. So you get a green. Well, that's stupid. And that's an educational term, folks, of course. Not a generic opinion. When the facts are so clear and you don't act on the basis of them, it's stupid. What's the difference between being stupid and is it ignorant?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the ignorant, they don't know. The facts.
They're oblivious, sure.
But maybe it's not their fault.
Sure.
But stupid is when the simple facts are in your face and you still do something else. Okay. So, and you say, well, facts are can be interpreted. Yes. All right. Not these. That was a stupid regulation that you can get green just by filing the annual report and getting more than 96% of your students to take the test. Of course, I guess I have to show up for school in order to take the test. So absenteeism.
There's no absentee ballots.
Absenteeism is a big problem in urban schools and mm-hmm. probably even in Dearborn. So that's why they couldn't even get there to take the test. They should have picked them up from home and driven them there individually. Their teacher should be responsible for picking up every student and getting them there.
It would have been cheaper in the long run.
Yeah, they would have saved that $2.5 million and had the red designation. But who would have known? Craig Foran goes on, he says, which means we could well see some of our historically top schools and districts not getting green, even if they perform well on the MEAP test and even the ACT test. And when we can't have that happen, so McMillan and fellow Republicans, many of which also come from those wealthier school districts in Michigan, say that let's stop the Common Core standards in their tracks because related tests may further adversely affect high-performing schools. They didn't say that, but now it looks pretty obvious, doesn't it, says Craig. I mean, says Craig, his Rochester schools are consistently in the top 90 percentile, okay, in the state's top to bottom ranking, with only two of its buildings ranking less than 90. And yet, not a single Rochester school received a green card. All yellows and one orange. In case you've forgotten, the ratings go from green to lime green to yellow to orange to red. Another case in point is the Bloomfield Hills School District, one of the most prestigious in the state. Not a single school received a green card, yellows. And Losher High School was red carded. Huh? No, not a single Dearborn Heights or Downriver school received a green either, but neither did an area school get a red card. Dearborn's Henry Ford Early College got a green, but that's not a traditional school. It's a charter school, right? Early College is a I think of it as a school within a school. That's when they can come to Henry Ford Community College and still be in high school at the same time. But I guess they're identified as an early college student. To further muddy the waters, the state says its top-to-bottom ranking gives the percentage of schools in the state that had lower achievement improvement. For example, a percentile rank of 90 means that 90% of schools statewide scored below the school's result. And the understatements of understatements was this line from the state, quote, "This is the fourth year the state has created statewide rankings. The methodology has changed somewhat, and results may not be comparable to prior year rankings," unquote. "Ya think?" says Craig. The highest-ranked area school was Dearborn's Howard Elementary School, which was in the 96th percentile, but still got a yellow. "So what does it take to get some respect around here?" he says in parentheses. Gros Eels Park Lane Elementary was the next highest-ranking local school, 93rd percentile, and a yellow. The bottom line is that the sooner our state standardizes its educational model with the national Common Core standards, the sooner we'll have some kind of logical method for rating, ranking, and helping our schools and our school children. Protecting the good schools isn't going to help anyone, and it doesn't work anyway. That's the opinion of Craig Ferrand from the Press and Guide. Thank you for that additional research, and I hope that explains to our listeners a little bit more of the mess we're in. And of course, finally, you know, achieving those Common Core standards, even if they're appropriate and sorted out, there has to be some additional funding to make those changes. You know,
I have to applaud the is that from the Press and Guide?
Yes.
Both of those were.
Yeah.
Just two fine editorials that they were. They cleared things up. Something, I don't know. A lot of people have had a lot of questions about this lately.
Just 5 minutes until Highway 61 begins, the Best in Blues with Joanne K. 2 to 6 p.m. today on WHFR, the station making waves, WHFR.fm. We mentioned last week that we thought maybe there was still something to be completed between Dearborn and Melvindale Fire Department merger. Well, it's now complete. Both city councils sat down and signed off, and so I assume Melvindale got their $1.2 million grant to help it out. I don't know, but it's done. It's done. So
they got a dollar, I know that, for the lease.
Well, there you go, a dollar.
Because
okay.
Dearborn gives them a dollar to lease the Melvindale Fire Department.
That's not bad, I guess.
Okay. Come on,
and it should be better service for all of us. We've covered this before with a number of people, even though the details of responsibilities and, you know, personnel and management and so on had to be all worked out, of course, but it has been. So good job, folks. And it should result in a better result, even though we always had good fire response times in Dearborn, fire service response times. And a great story in the Times-Herald is last Wednesday, because, you know, we had talked about the projected deficit a few months ago here at Henry Ford Community College, and we had our new president, Stan Jensen, on talking about that, and we're making changes, and we have to somehow balance the budget at least and get a little bit ahead to start putting in our rainy day fund this year. $16.6 million in debt. Well, you might ask, how's that going? He did it. Yep, along with faculty, staff, administrators working together. This is the fastest turnaround I've ever heard. It's projected now that by the end of the school year, next June 2014, we will be $1.4 million ahead, which, since we have no reserve, will immediately go into the rainy day fund. I think they need to build up about $10 million there to take care of ebbs and, you know, ups and downs of enrollment from year to year. So we still have a ways to go, but we're on the right track, and there's now new contracts from faculty on campus that will save the college $5.7 million a year. So it's givebacks, it's salary cuts, it's pay freezes, it's, you know, and the 14 administrators were laid off by President Jensen. It's many things. He's reorganized a lot of stuff here.
Tuition hike.
And yet we're still probably going to be the second lowest tuition for college in Michigan, which is unfortunate because everybody needs to get a college education to the extent that they're qualified, of course. But that's why I agree with Jim Hightower and many other experts, is that, yes, our country should bite the bullet. There should be free college tuition for those that are qualified everywhere in the U.S. Oh, that'll cost a fortune. Yeah, but look at all the other costs. Look at the debts we're putting our kids into if they go to college. They're in debt for almost all their life, trying to pay off the loan. And then they have no lives because they have to pay off a loan. They can't even afford to buy a house. They have to go live with their parents. They don't even probably can't afford very much of a car. It's torturous. It's wrong. You know, and so that's, yeah, I'm in favor of free tuition for all those that qualify at whatever college you want to go to, whether it's a four-year school or a community college. But again, qualifications matter. Community colleges right now have more what's used to be called remedial programs. So if you just didn't get all the skills you needed, you were out to lunch or out of town or something in the first 18 years of your education, you probably had to go to a community college because we have those programs in place to help you.
They're called developmental.
Developmental, that's right. They're not remedial. They're developmental now. And with that in mind, that's what we should do. And, of course, the countries that are doing the best in higher ed, mostly Scandinavian countries, is it Denmark or is it Finland?
I thought Norway.
Finland. Well, one of them have free tuition
right. For
all those that qualify. And everybody helps pay for it in their taxes, yep. But it takes all the rigmarole, all the red tape, all the hassle out of how to fund colleges that we have now. It's a big mess, folks. From somebody who's been inside college for 45 years here and inside the administration, this is not the way to run the system. Sort of like this is not the way to run health care in the U.S. right now. And even Obamacare may be a slight nudge. The actual reforms that are part of Obamacare, it is called the Affordable Care Act, but the reforms are totally essential that are part of that. They're totally essential. Those that say, I want to repeal Obamacare, well, you don't really want to repeal those reforms of the present system. Now, expansion of Medicare, that's we can debate that a little bit if you want to, but the reforms we got to have. We've got to get control and get a better healthcare system here. And yes, it has to be top down so it can be consistent throughout all the states. Yes, it does. Even though, boy, I've got my Libertarian Party card. Okay, I'm not a Tea Partyist, but you know, I love Ron Paul, and not personally, but you know, I love his philosophies. Read all of his books, but there are exceptions where the federal government can do it best. Yes, the federal government can do some things well, but it has to be set up right in the first place. And politicking apparently doesn't get it set up right
in
the state of Michigan either. Okay, quickie. Whoa, it's 2 o'clock. It's WHFR Dearborn. I'm waiting for Joanne to get here. We'll keep filling Drinking in America last weekend here at the Adrae Auditorium in the Fine Arts Center at Henry Ford Community College main campus. Tonight, tomorrow night, 8 p.m. and 2 p.m. Sunday. It's got a great review by Sue Suchita in the Dearborn Times Herald this week. Although if you review it, it'll take some of the fun out of it. But
yeah.
It's a serious, mature drama. And it's really, really excellent. And so do something different, something very artistically sound this weekend. If you're in town, it's Labor Day weekend. Watch your driving out there, too, as you're coming to Drinking in America. Don't be drinking in America. Yeah. By the way, Judge Summers' case, where the city got a ruling that they don't have to pay his $1.2 million judgment against him. He has now stated in the Press and Guide from this last Wednesday that he is going to appeal to the U.S. District Court of Appeals that the whole judgment, I think, not just the ruling about who pays for it. By the way, also on Wednesday, another great op-ed, Glenn Gilbert, who writes not every week but many weeks for the Press and Guide, Medicaid expansion must happen in Michigan to meet the needs of residents. And there's still, I don't think it's been finalized. The Senate in Michigan in Lansing voted yes to accept the Medicaid. Governor Snyder's for it. Don't know what's happening in the House. Did they adjourn from weekend without deciding?
That's what I had heard.
Yeah, okay. So read Glenn Gilbert and maybe tell your representatives what's up. Thank you for listening today. Oh, by the way, there was a final point. I was going to play it.